content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 8th, September 15th issue of the Week. During last week's show, I missed the fact that we were working out of one of their two-week issues of the week, September 8th, September 15th. And so we'll take a second tour through that issue, slightly different order of events and articles. Some of the news pieces may seem a little dated, but we've got plenty of interesting material. We will start with the one main story we didn't read last week. Trump's federal election fraud trial set for March. What happened? The judge overseeing the federal case charging Donald Trump with conspiring to overturn the 2020 election rejected his bid this week to postpone the trial until after the 2024 election, setting a trial date for March 4th, 2024. That's one day before Super Tuesday, when 14 states will hold their presidential primaries. Special Prosecutor Jack Smith had requested a January trial, calling that time frame absurd. Trump lawyer John Lauro asked for an April 2026 trial. But U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan called that long delay far beyond what was necessary to prepare a defense. She said there is a societal interest to a speedy trial, and that, like any other defendant, Trump cannot delay justice because of his professional obligations. Trump called Chutkan a biased, Trump-hating judge and vowed to appeal. The trial date set by federal judges generally can't be appealed. Last week, Trump surrendered at Fulton County Jail in Atlanta on racketeering charges connected to his efforts to overturn his 2020 loss in the state. He had his mugshot taken, a first for a former president, and was released on $200,000 bail. Former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, one of 19 co-defendants in the Georgia case, testified for hours in support of an effort to convince a state judge to move his case to a federal courtroom. Meadows is arguing that it belongs there because his attempts to challenge Trump's election loss were part of his official federal duties. Meadows' actions included traveling to and trying to gain access to a ballot audit in suburban Atlanta and setting up the infamous call in which Trump asked Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find 11,780 Trump votes. What the editorial said. What a spectacular mess, said the Wall Street Journal. Instead of barnstorming states on Super Tuesday, Trump may be stuck in a federal courtroom. And how the public will respond is anybody's guess. Some Republicans will be inclined to vote for him just to give a middle finger to an establishment they think is railroading him. But they should recognize that his legal risks are political risks for the GOP, which would be foolish to roll the dice. Good for Chutkan for rejecting Trump's garbage and insisting on a timely trial, said the New York Daily News. As it happens, March 4th has symbolic importance. Through much of U.S. history, it was Inauguration Day. The peaceful transfer of power that took place on that day was a sacred tradition until Trump and his gangsters decided to launch a coup against democracy. Holding them accountable isn't about politics. It's about upholding the rule of law. What the columnist said. Trump's path to the GOP nomination is littered with court dates, said Kyle Cheney in Politico. He's a defendant in seven pending cases, including three lawsuits and four criminal prosecutions carrying 91 felony counts. starting next month when Trump and his business organization face trial in a civil suit filed by New York's Attorney General. He'll face a near constant string of trials, even as he campaigns for the presidency. The New York hush money trial is set for March 25th, while Smith's declassified documents trial is scheduled for May 20th. Putting Trump on trial before many of the primaries is a big mistake, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Republican primary voters will have to cast ballots without knowing whether Trump will be convicted. In a recent poll, 45% of GOP voters said they wouldn't support him if he's convicted of a felony. Conducting trials during primaries will only serve to rally Republicans around the candidate perceived to be liberalism's major target. Trump's scowling, instantly ubiquitous mugshot will go down in the history books, said Arwa Madawi in The Guardian. But will it illustrate his demise or his political resurrection? Despite Trump's bombast, multiple felony trials won't help his presidential campaign. And as Trump's legal woes mount, independents are steadily turning against him. It may seem utterly implausible that this lawless, dangerous demagogue may return to the White House, but 2016 taught us to never say never. He may yet make mugs of us all. We'll do a handful of the short pieces, combining the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance, starting fairly close to home for us, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Campus shooting. A University of North Carolina graduate student accused of killing his faculty advisor at a chemistry lab on the Chapel Hill campus was charged with first-degree murder this week. The school was locked down for 3 hours after Talee Key, a second-year grad student, allegedly used a 9mm pistol to fatally shoot Zi Yan, an associate professor in the Department of Applied Physical Sciences. Key, 34, was arrested near his home soon after. Police said they had yet to determine a motive for the attack. Key, a Chinese citizen with a visa to study in the U.S., had previously expressed anger in social media posts about women and his faculty advisor. "Bully in America seems to be a problem," he wrote. Professor Yan had recently expressed concern to a colleague about an unnamed grad student who was struggling with mental illness and delusions. Huntington, West Virginia. Abortion ruling. West Virginia can restrict the sale of the abortion pill mifepristone, a federal judge ruled last week, even though the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the drug as safe. District Court Judge Robert C. Chambers said the state's near-total ban on abortions, signed last September, takes precedence over decisions by federal regulators. The Supreme Court has made it clear that states may appropriately exercise their police power in regulating abortions, Chambers wrote. The ruling could complicate efforts by abortion rights proponents to protect access to abortion drugs, which account for a majority of terminations in the U.S. in states that restricted abortion access following the overturning of Roe v. Wade. A legal challenge to mifepristone's FDA approval is likely headed to the Supreme Court. In West Virginia, Chambers allowed a challenge to proceed concerning whether the drug can be prescribed via telemedicine. This comes from Loch Ness, Scotland. Monster Hunt, the biggest coordinated search in decades for the fabled Loch Ness Monster, ended this week without finding Nessie. Some 200 enthusiasts, armed with sonar microphones and drones, scoped the 23-mile-long lake for signs of the creature. And when one team heard four distinctive gloops underwater, we all got a bit excited, search leader Alan McKenna told the Telegraph. Alas, the sounds likely came from ducks. The Loch Ness Monster has been drawing people to the highlands since Robert Wilson released his famous photograph of a dinosaur-like beast in 1934. The photo was later exposed as a hoax, but the myth persisted, and Nessie tourism now generates $52 million a year. This is from Tripoli, Libya. Foreign minister flees. Libya Foreign Minister Najla Mangouche fled to Turkey this week after protests erupted over revelations that she'd quietly met with her Israeli counterpart last week in Rome. Israel has been pushing to normalize relations with the Arab world, and Israel Foreign Minister Eli Cohen announced the meeting proudly, saying the two discussed preserving Libya's ancient synagogues and possible Israeli humanitarian aid. That went over poorly in Libya, which doesn't recognize Israel and has a population devoted to the Palestinian cause. Demonstrations broke out in several cities, and protesters burned Israeli flags. Libyan Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Dibah blamed Mangouche and suspended her, but other officials said he had approved the sit-down to curry favor with the U.S. Paris. Wine down the drain. Facing a wine surplus that has caused prices to plummet, France is paying farmers to turn their unbottled barrels into distilled alcohol for use in cleaning products and perfume. The government earmarked some $44 million last week on top of $172 million from the EU to compensate French winemakers for destroying nearly 80 million gallons of wine. Thanks to a growing taste for beer, coupled with the closure of many wine bars during the pandemic, wine consumption is down 15% so far this year. We're producing too much, and the sale price is below the production price, so we're losing money, said winemaker Jean-Philippe Granier. France has also begun paying vineyards to rip out their vines and find more profitable uses for the land. Moscow. Drone attacks. Ukrainian drones rained down across six Russian regions this week in the biggest attack on Russian territory since the war began 18 months ago. The drone assault damaged at least four Russian military planes and forced airport closures across the country. Russia countered with a sustained barrage of missiles aimed at Kyiv. On both sides, most of the drones were shot down, but two Ukrainian security guards at a factory were killed. Also this week, Russia released footage of imprisoned American Paul Whelan, a former U.S. Marine detained since 2018 on espionage charges he strongly denies, in his prison camp. It was good to see the fight remains in his eyes, said Whelan's brother David. McMurdo Station, Antarctica. U.S. outpost rife with sexism. Women at a U.S. scientific research center in Antarctica face persistent, sometimes violent, sexual harassment, an Associated Press investigative report found this week, and management has ignored their complaints. One woman at McMurdo Station was fired after she reported being sexually assaulted. Another was made to work alongside her attacker. Liz Monahan, a mechanic, said she was stalked and threatened by one man, and when authorities did nothing, her immediate superior sent her on a dangerous 8-day resupply journey across the ice just to get her away from him. Women make up 30% of workers at the remote outpost, and the National Science Foundation, which oversees the U.S. Antarctic program, found in its own report last year that more than half of them had reported harassment or assault. We'll read a few of the best columns that we passed over last week. This one comes from the U.S. Near misses at the airports. American air travel has become shockingly safe with no fatal commercial airline crashes since 2009, said Dan Kwa. But the next big crash is coming. A New York Times report revealed last week that near-miss incidents at airports and runways have doubled over the past decade, with three in July alone. One database identified 300 reported incidents of near collisions involving commercial airlines over the past year, with some planes passing within feet of each other on overcrowded runways. Pilots and air traffic controllers say that everyone's bracing for catastrophe. With 3 million people flying in the U.S. every day, 310 of the nation's 313 air traffic control facilities are understaffed. And controllers are hideously overworked. Many work six-day weeks. Pilots are in short supply, too, after airlines offered buyouts during the pandemic. And they're hiring newcomers with less flight experience. Only 43 of the nation's more than 500 commercial airports have surface detection systems to alert controllers that planes are on collision courses. As a result, near crashes are becoming frighteningly commonplace. The FAA and the airlines have been pushing their luck, and if nothing changes, it won't be long until the luck runs out. From the UK, a country ruled by grannies. A secret cabal controls British politics, said Robert Colville. But it's not some shadowy network of global elites. It's your Nan's Bridge Club. Time and again, on decision after decision, our politicians put the elderly first. While the country suffers through inflation and a recession, older Brits keep getting handouts from gold-plated pension increases to subsidies for their winter fuel bills. Their millennial grandchildren, meanwhile, are crushed by student loans and some of the world's highest child care costs, and shut out from home ownership by hilariously unaffordable housing. The explanation for this disparity in treatment is obvious. It's the elderly who vote. Politicians have little incentive to push for more housing or cheaper childcare if their constituents don't demand it. But we ignore these problems at everyone's peril. The Office for National Statistics recently announced that the fertility rate for British-born women plunged 22% in the past decade, an astonishing decline. Young people apparently feel so glum about their prospects that they are delaying starting families or dropping the idea altogether. Such pessimism presents a slow-moving disaster for the country. Without new youngsters to enter the workforce and pay into the pension funds, we will risk the whole generational Ponzi scheme toppling over. Russia. With Prigozhin dead, can Putin control Wagner? Hardline Russian nationalists are in mourning for mercenary chief Yevgeny Prigozhin, said Sergei Zhitnikov in Novaya Gazeta. Prigozhin's private jet crashed north of Moscow last week, killing the Wagner Group boss and nine companions. Within hours, camo-clad former fighters were laying candles and flowers outside Wagner's St. Peter's headquarters and drowning their sorrows in vodka. Men approached the spontaneous memorial, fell to their knees, banged their heads on the asphalt, and sobbed. Prigozhin was the only one of all those Kremlin riffraff who told the truth, one man said, a reference to Prigozhin's withering criticism of Russian military failures in Ukraine. That discontent fueled Wagner's brief uprising against Putin in June that ended in its commander's apparent assassination. Its roughly 50,000 men are now scattered and leaderless, their future unclear. About 5,000 Wagnerites fled to Belarus, and that's making Belarus' European neighbors nervous, said Friedrich Schmidt in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia were already concerned that Moscow would use Wagner's presence in Belarus to menace NATO's eastern frontier. With Prigozhin out of the way, fears that Putin will hatch a plan have only grown. Leaders in Warsaw, Vilnius, and Riga demanded the immediate removal of the mercenaries this week and threatened to close their country's borders with Belarus. While Belarus dictator, Kremlin ally Alexander Lukashenko, insists that Wagner is welcome to stay. But to do what? And for whom? Putin's priority is assuming control of Prigozhin's forces in Africa, said Max Sedin in the Financial Times. Wagner is a crucial plank in Russian power projection in Africa, lending muscle to regimes from Mali to Libya. But Prigozhin was the only one crazy enough to make it work, one Prigozhin associate told me. That's all going to go to shit now. Wagner is not a corporation you can simply hire a new CEO to run, said Denis Korotkov in Meduza. It is a sprawling mercenary network that runs on a web of illicit personal ties and pays its debts with bags of cash. The hierarchical Russian military can't replicate that nimble structure. If the Kremlin tries to somehow resubordinate Wagner fighters in Africa, it will fail. Still, someone will be named the new head, said Sergei Derkachev in Don News, and it's likely to be Anton Lotus Elizarov, a Russian military veteran who has commanded Wagner operations in Syria, Ukraine, and all over Africa. He has pledged to follow Prigozhin's brutal example of victory no matter what. In intelligence circles, said Il Sole 24 Ore, in a unsigned article, rumors are circulating that Putin has secretly tapped notorious arms leader Viktor Bout to lead Wagner. Bout, who once smuggled weapons to terrorists and insurgents across Africa and the Middle East, served 10 years in a U.S. federal prison until being traded back to Russia last year in exchange for U.S. basketball player Brittany Griner. His ascension could indicate an important turning point in the evolution of Wagner. We'll spend some time in the business pages this week, starting with an article on the business news at a glance. Pharma, Medicare drug price negotiations. The Biden administration this week released a list of the first 10 prescription drugs subject to price negotiations with Medicare, said Rachel Kors and Matthew Herper in Stat News. The drugs were chosen from a list of 50 treatments that cost Medicare's pharmacy drug benefit the most, and they included blood thinners, Eliquis, and Xarelto, and the diabetes drug Jardiance. Eventual discounts on drugs could range from 25% off to 60%, depending on how long they've been on the market. Drug makers have no choice but to accept the government's price or face penalties that include losing Medicare and Medicaid coverage for all their medications. The government might not save that much initially, said Caitlin Owens in Axios. The 10 drugs cost Medicare more than $50 billion last year, but that's before accounting for rebates already negotiated by Part D plans and other discounts. That means the negotiated prices on several drugs may not end up being much, if at all, lower than what the government currently pays on net for them. But any discount would help seniors contend with soaring drug prices. The savings from the new rules, part of the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, will really kick in once Medicare starts negotiating the prices of drugs with fewer rebates, like cancer drugs, Xandi and Ibrance. Here's a few short news pieces. Between the pre-pandemic month of January 2020 and July 2023, the immigrant labor force grew by 9.5%, compared with just 1.5% growth rate in the U.S.-born workforce. Michael Jordan's sale of his stake in the Charlotte Hornets this month cemented his net worth at an estimated $3.5 billion. Last year, the Jordan brand recorded $5.1 billion in revenue, representing almost 11% of Nike's total sales. According to Redfin, 38% of home buyers under the age 30 either used a cash gift from a family member or an inheritance to afford their down payment. This is a Making Money article. Auto inflation. The end of the economy car. Just 5 years ago, a price-conscious auto shopper in the United States could choose from among a dozen new small cars selling for under $20,000, said Tom Krischer in the Associated Press. Today, there's just one, the Mitsubishi Mirage, selling for an average of $19,205 last month, according to Cox Automotive. That's about as much as a four-year-old Chevy Cruze or Mazda 3 is going for on the used market. The average price on a new car today is just above $48,000, a difference of 25% from before the pandemic. Small, affordable cars just don't exist anymore. Detroit's big three automakers, along with Toyota and Honda, began to jettison the compact and some subcompact car business about 5 years ago, in favor of SUVs and trucks that promise better profit margins. Even six digits isn't such a premium price point anymore. There are now 32 new vehicle models in the U.S. with a retail price over $100,000. In 2018, there were only 12. Sticker shock isn't hitting just new car buyers, said Brendan Rarick in Money. 4 years ago, nearly half, 49.3% of the entire used car market in the U.S. was made up of cars priced under $20,000. Today, the share of cheap used cars has dropped to a mere 12.4%. It means cars are becoming unaffordable for more Americans, said Ben Foldy in the Wall Street Journal. For the average American, paying off a new car at current prices demands 42 weeks of income, according to Cox, up from 33 before the pandemic. The average new car loan exceeds $750 per month with an interest rate of 9.5%. Worryingly, the pace at which defaults and missed payments are occurring on auto loans is beginning to match or exceed 2008's. Meanwhile, automakers who leaned into their pricing power during the pandemic, when inventory was scarcer, have made dealerships big profits. "You can't overestimate the demand for big cars," said Anna Teresa Sola in CNBC.com. During the second quarter, more than one in four vehicle shoppers in Texas and Wyoming committed to paying more than $1,000 a month for a new car, typically a full-size pickup truck. Such trucks costing close to $100,000 made up 14.5% of the total market in 2022, driving up the average price of all cars. "Cheap cars should still exist," said Jason Torchinsky in The Autopian. "The Mirage knew what it was and lived up to that role. Cheap, but it worked. Now it, too, is rumored to be disappearing soon, meaning more people who just need decent, honest transport are going to be shoved into a big, expensive vehicle that will feel cramped because they're loaded up with debt." Here's a few of the business columns. First up, locked down. Stores struggle to deter rising thefts. "Retailers are blaming rampant shoplifting for their shrinking bottom line," said Hamza Shaban in Yahoo.com. In waves of earnings calls last week, major store chains like Dick's Sporting Goods, Target, Macy's, Home Depot, and Dollar Tree took pains to mention the theme of missing merchandise in hits to their quarterly profits. Videos of brazen smash-and-grab looting operations, sometimes involving hundreds of masked individuals, appear in the news almost weekly, adding to the sense of lawlessness. Retailers lost $94.5 billion in 2021, nearly double the amount from 2018, to inventory shrink, an industry term that refers to lost or stolen merchandise. More retailers are responding by putting items in locked cases and even taking often stolen items out of stores. "These attacks aren't carried out by small groups of petty criminals," said Stephen Malanga in City Journal. "There is a sophisticated illicit infrastructure underpinning this activity that's all about reselling stolen items for profit. The merchandise is sold by operators online, where they are hard to deter or track down. Often it winds up on large anonymous marketplaces like Amazon and eBay. The illegal industry includes cleaners who strip goods of security devices and money launderers who process the transactions. But enabling this behavior are the states that have decriminalized low-level shoplifting under the misconception that most thieves have turned to stealing to put food on the table. More than two-thirds of states now treat shoplifting as a misdemeanor if the value boosted is less than $1,000. Retailers aren't helping when they refer to this problem with jargon like shrink, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Plain language about theft rather than the euphemism would make the public better understand how bad the problem is and build support for policies that would do something about it. Shrink is a purposefully vague term, said Gabrielle Fongrouge in CNBC.com. Companies say repeatedly that organized theft drove shrink without explicitly breaking down how much of the inventory loss is due to crime or how it has changed over time. Shrink can just as easily be explained by employee theft, administrative error, and inventory damage. In fact, internal pilfering has traditionally been the largest contributor to shrink, since retail employees have access to entire cases of merchandise in back rooms or warehouses. But it's easier to blame gangs of criminals than to admit to having internal challenges or poor hiring practices. Shoplifting hurts more than just profit, said Stacy Torres in the Los Angeles Times. Shopping at Target or the supermarket used to be my happy place, but locked glass cabinets safeguarding merchandise are now ubiquitous. It's demoralizing to have to ask clerks to retrieve your deodorant. At my local Safeway, you have to enter through an automatic gate rigged with alarms if you try to exit the same way. Companies say these measures are there to make us all feel safe, but to me, they make it feel like visiting a prison. Silicon Valley plans for its perfect city. For years, landowners have wondered about the secretive buyer who's been scooping up thousands of acres of farmland, paying several times the market rate outside San Francisco, said Connor Doherty and Aaron Griffith. Was it Disney or China? Turns out the mysterious business, disguised by the name Flannery Associates, is the brainchild of a 36-year-old former Goldman Sachs trader. He has courted some of the tech industry's biggest names to fund a $900 million plan to build an entire city from scratch. This ex-urban utopia would form a metropolis as walkable as Paris, where construction methods and new forms of governance could be rethought. If, that is, the local residents are willing to rezone land that's given over largely to ranches, windmills, and power lines. The vision has been catnip to a who's who of Silicon Valley elites. The list of backers includes superstar venture capitalist Mark Andreessen, Laureen Powell Jobs, the LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, longtime VC heavyweight Michael Moritz, who has helped recruit investors to the project since 2017, said the new city would relieve some of the Silicon Valley pressures we all feel, such as congestion and homelessness. And one more plus. If the plan succeeds, for Moritz and other investors, the financial gains would be huge. Democracy, Fast Casual Edition. What does Olive Garden do better than every other business? Asked Catherine Rampell. It brings people together. Seriously, a new working paper by Maxim Massenkoff of the Naval Postgraduate School and Nathan Wilmers of MIT Sloan School of Management analyzed a massive trove of geolocation data to assess where and when Americans come into contact with people of different income classes than themselves. In general, the paper finds that people at the very top and the very bottom of the income distribution are the least likely to mingle with people in other classes. But whether you're rich, poor, or in between, there is surprisingly little socioeconomic cross-pollination. Even a drug chain like CVS mostly gets customers shopping at the branch within their own neighborhoods, where they might encounter only people who look like themselves. The same thinking falls across public institutions, like parks, libraries, churches, and especially schools. So where are Americans most likely to bump into someone different? At Applebee's or Olive Garden? The researchers found that full-service, affordable restaurant chains are the most socioeconomically diverse places in America. This, in a way, represents an unsung achievement of capitalism. We can all appreciate a plate of moderately priced nachos. Thank you. We're going to read a technology article and then maybe two or so of the health and science shorts. Back to school, the chatbot invasion. Teachers should go into this school year assuming that 100% of their students are using ChatGPT and other generative AI tools on every assignment, said Kevin Roos in the New York Times. Last year was a rude awakening. In the middle of an academic year, with no warning, teachers were forced to confront the new alien-seeming technology that could almost instantaneously produce college-level essays. Some schools responded to the threat of chatbot-enabled cheating by banning ChatGPT altogether. Entering year two, there is a fair bit of curiosity and even excitement over AI's role in the classroom. Last year, many schools tried to scare students away from using AI by telling them that tools like ChatGPT are unreliable, prone to spitting out nonsensical answers, and generic-sounding prose. But AI has improved, and teachers need to use it themselves to understand what it can do. Thinking you can bring AI into the classroom is naive, said English professor Mark Massaro in The Hill. AI is corrupting education. Students are taking AI-written essays and running them through a rephrasing generator, which rewords the uploaded essays with synonyms to mask the original computerized nature of the product. How are we supposed to counteract that? Today, the subjective process of critical and logical thinking is a more important skill than ever. But AI removes the struggle or engagement with information. Few of us in the faculty room are responding to this threat with the appropriate fear. AI has infected higher education like a death watch beetle, hollowing out sound structures from the inside until the imminent collapse. I am using ChatGPT in my classroom, said Elizabeth Blakely in the Los Angeles Times, to teach my students that anything that chatbots can do, they can do better. I asked the chatbot to write my lecture on the history of broadcast media. Unsurprisingly, the text it generated was horrible, so I'll have my students write a better one, turning each cliche into original imagery and poor word choices into something more precise. Tech companies naturally want to bring AI into the classroom quickly, said Nadia Bidarian in CNN.com. The results so far, though, are not encouraging. Khan Academy is testing its AI tutor with 8,000 students and educators this fall, where students can chat with a growing list of AI-powered historical figures, from George Washington to Cleopatra. Sounds great in theory, but there's plenty of work left to do. Conmigo asked me to divide 10,332 by 4, then told me my accurate answer was wrong. 3 separate times. COVID has long-term effects on most. Even if you don't think you are suffering from long COVID, the effects of the infection could be lingering years after recovery, the Washington Post reports. An analysis of Veterans Administration records shows that the nearly 139,000 veterans who tested positive in 2020 before vaccines still had higher than normal risk for conditions such as fatigue, diabetes, blood clots, and lung and kidney dysfunction 2 years later, compared with the much larger control group of VA patients who didn't test positive. They also had a 250% higher risk of losing their sense of smell and 27% higher risk of stroke. Those whose COVID cases landed them in the hospital were even worse off, with a nearly 30% higher risk of dying over the next 2 years and dramatically elevated risk for developing diabetes, Alzheimer's, and memory loss. That's a staggeringly high burden, said study co-author Ziad Al-Ali of Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. The sample size of veterans skewed elderly and was 90% male. Further research is needed to determine whether newer variants in vaccinated people cause similarly long-lasting effects. But it's likely that COVID did not forget about you, Al-Ali says. It's still wreaking havoc in your body. Babies need faces, not screens. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends zero screen time for babies. A new study strengthens that case, linking daily screen time for one-year-olds to delayed development in toddlerhood. The Japanese survey followed more than 7,000 new mothers for 4 years, asking them about their baby's daily exposure to screens, TV, video games, tablets, and smartphones, and the children's developmental milestones. About 51% said they allowed their one-year-olds 1 or up to 4 hours on screens. The following year, those children were more likely to struggle with communication and problem-solving skills. The children of the 4% of mothers who allowed babies more than 4 hours of screen time a day were nearly 5 times as likely to experience communication delays. In-person parental or caregiver interaction imparts crucial information about language, expressions, and the physical environment to babies that doesn't happen when you're watching the screen. Yale development psychologist David L. Lukowicz tells the New York Times, talk to your child as much as you can, face to face. And we're on the talking points page. Looks like time for a couple of articles here. First up, Musk, his growing power over government. The U.S. government is dangerously beholden to Elon Musk, said Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker. The billionaire's rocket company, SpaceX, is currently the sole means by which NASA can get astronauts into space from U.S. soil. Another venture, Tesla, controls the country's biggest network of electric vehicle charging stations, giving it an outsized say in transportation and energy policy. Musk's Starlink satellite internet service, meanwhile, is crucial to defense policy. Pentagon officials were forced to plead with the tech mogul last fall after some Ukrainian units lost access to Starlink, either their main battlefield communication tool, while fighting Russian forces. Musk had earlier demanded that the U.S. pay for Ukraine's discounted Starlink service and had started pushing a pro-Russia peace plan, apparently dreamed up after one-on-one talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The U.S. later struck a deal on Starlink, but officials remain uneasy about their reliance on Musk. We are living off his good graces, said a Pentagon official. That sucks. Musk has unprecedented power in his hands, said Peter Sathy in The Wrap, and those hands seem shakier and more erratic each day. Look at his disastrous efforts to remake X, formerly known as Twitter. Since buying the social media company for $44 billion last year, he has alienated advertisers and users by letting hate speech flourish and by firing staffers responsible for maintaining critical infrastructure. Could drug use be responsible for Musk's increasingly bizarre behavior? Asked Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. Musk associates suggested to Farrow that the billionaire, a workaholic who struggles with loneliness and stress, has upped his use of ketamine in recent years. A depression treatment and a party drug, ketamine can feed impulsiveness and feelings of grandeur. So U.S. policy is heavily dependent on a man who may or may not have his judgment heavily influenced by pharmaceuticals. Cool. For now, the government is stuck with Musk, said Tim Fernholz in Quartz. It has spent billions of dollars trying to build Boeing and Blue Origin into private alternatives to SpaceX, but those firms have repeatedly failed to deliver. But relying on one person with erratic behavior and connections to authoritarian foreign governments, Tesla produces half its cars in China, is a real problem. SpaceX is dependent on government funding, and officials should be bolder in using that as leverage. Still, until a serious rival to Musk emerges, this risky codependency will continue. Travel. Why tourists are behaving badly. This feels like the summer of bad tourist, said Natalie B. Compton in the Washington Post. Across Europe and beyond, entitled travelers have gone rogue, grabbing headlines with their vandalism, tantrums, and narcissism. There's the woman who shocked Romans last month by climbing across the venerated Trevi Fountain to fill her water bottle. The Bulgarian man who scratched his girlfriend's name into the 2,000-year-old Colosseum. And the two drunk Americans who recently slept off a heavy night in Paris' Eiffel Tower. Visitors have damaged unique geological landforms in China, belly-flopped into Venice's canals, and horrified locals in Bali by getting drunk, naked, and violent. Tourists acting out is nothing new, but many behaviorists and travel industry veterans think things are getting worse. More travelers feel they should be able to do whatever they want, said cultural studies researcher Christy Sedgman. Never mind manners, rules, and social norms. Fed-up tourist hotspots are pushing back, said Lebowit Lily Gurma in Bloomberg. Bali has closed off some sacred sites to tourists and ramped up deportations, sending hundreds packing this summer. Officials in the overrun Croatian city of Dubrovnik started a campaign to discourage behavior such as parading through the historic city center in bathing suits and dragging wheeled suitcases along cobblestone streets, which generates a click, click, click noise that torments locals. In picturesque Portofino, Italy, selfie-taking tourists who obstruct traffic are subject to fines. Some destinations have taken more creative measures, said Chris Livesay in CBSNews.com. In Spain, locals have posted signs at beaches warning of fake dangers like jellyfish and falling rocks. A number of forces are at work here, said Larry Blyberg in BBC.com. Tourists eager to make up for lost pandemic years are deluging cities with a revenge travel mentality, dictating that no whim should be denied. Desperation for social media likes leads some people to extreme behavior, such as stripping down in public. But social media is also a vehicle for calling out problem travelers, and that's a good thing. With each new report of cringeworthy, tone-deaf, or just plain disrespectful behavior, our collective outrage seems to be rising, creating a moment of reckoning for bad tourists. This shaming drives home an important message we should all heed. International travel is a privilege, and privilege brings responsibility. We'll take a few of the short notes. Donald Trump's campaign raised $7.1 million in the first 48 hours after he was booked in an Atlanta jail. That includes $4.18 million raised the day after the booking, the highest one-day total for the campaign, which is marketing shirts, bumper stickers, and beverage coolers adorned with Trump's mugshot and the tagline, "Never surrender." The number of gender-affirming surgeries performed in the U.S. nearly tripled from 2016 to 2019, according to a new study, rising from about 4,550 a year to about 13,000. About 56% of the surgeries were for the breast or chest area, and 35% for genital reconstruction. About 7.7% of the surgeries were performed on people 12 to 18. The expiration of pandemic-era child care funding on September 30th will cause more than 70,000 facilities to close and more than 3 million children to be dropped from child care, the Century Foundation estimates. Arkansas, Montana, Utah, Virginia, West Virginia, and the District of Columbia could lose at least half of their licensed child care programs. And we will finish out today's program with a quote from publisher Catherine Graham, quoted in Jewish News Syndicate. She said, "News is what someone wants suppressed. Everything else is advertising." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.